I think you're going to see a total transformation of this part of the world. And it's being overlooked by the vast majority of people, which is what makes it exciting.
Welcome to the Global Investor Podcast. The goal of this podcast is to offer investors and entrepreneurs insights and practical advice to dramatically improve the kinds of deals you invest in and the returns you get. My name is James Evenson. I'm one of the partners at Crown Private and our investor syndicate, Obrus. Obrus is about exceptional people, unique experiences, and bespoke investment. Our membership and community are built up of like-minded yet unique and adventurous individuals, as well as family offices. We invest in a spectrum of deals from established companies to startups. We do so with a proven formula of due diligence, structuring, and management. Obrus had its start in frontier markets. Our first investor event was in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, 9 years ago. Our person on the ground at that time was Scott Osheroff. After completing university in the United States, Scott quickly found his way to Asia, where as of this date, he has lived in 6 countries, including Mongolia, Singapore, Myanmar, Cambodia, Vietnam, and most recently, Uzbekistan. Scott is the fund manager and chief information officer of Asia Frontier Capital's Uzbekistan Fund. He resides in Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan. We are interviewing Scott today with 2 goals in mind. The first is to provide a spotlight on frontier markets, and in particular, the emerging economy of Uzbekistan. And second, with 9 years under his belt, Scott understands a great deal about frontier markets, and he offers significant insights to those who are less familiar with Central Asia and frontier investing. Hey, Scott, welcome. Where do we find you today?
Hi, James. I'm in Tashkent, Uzbekistan.
Perfect. Well, for context, we met about 4 years ago, probably right about now, 4 years ago in Vietnam. We were in Ho Chi Minh for a joint conference that Asia Frontier Capital and Obrus were hosting. And we've also spent time in Myanmar together a few years ago. That was a while ago as well. Well, I shared a brief bio of you with our viewers, but I know that you're about much more than that. So why don't you give us a few highlights that you think are relevant for people to know about you as we enter into this interview?
Sure. Well, I guess the quick background, the one-minute sort of background would be I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to Northeastern University in Boston, studied finance or business with the concentration of finance, and realized during my summer internships that I didn't necessarily want to stay in the United States. So I did what any rational 21-year-old would do and say, I don't have a job. I'm not going to look for a job. I'll buy a one-way plane ticket to Asia and I'll figure it out. So ended up working with the founders of Capitalist Exploits on some things in private equity and created a partnership with them about 2 weeks before I came to Asia. But that saw me move to Mongolia for my first 6 months in Asia after snaking my way throughout Southeast Asia. And then over the past 9.5 years, I've lived between Mongolia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, Singapore, and most recently Uzbekistan. And then in 2014, I joined Asia Frontier Capital, which is a listed equities investment manager based in Hong Kong, focused on Asian frontier markets. So we have 4 funds, an Iraq fund, a Vietnam fund, a pan-frontier Asian fund, and our most recently launched Uzbekistan fund, which celebrated its 2-year anniversary just this past month, of which I'm the chief investment officer of.
Perfect. And we're going to delve into that here shortly as well. Let's talk a bit about Uzbekistan. You've been there for a little more than a year, weathering the pandemic quite well. I remember 2 years ago, when you were touring Central Asia, you spent some time in one of my homelands, Kazakhstan. And what was the appeal for Uzbekistan back then? Actually, let's even go back further. What made it appealing? What in its recent history has made it appealing for outside investment?
Sure. So Uzbekistan was sort of considered a second North Korea until 2016. You had capital controls, you had a secret police, you had, you were harassed at the airport. I had friends that would come here for tourism, and you were asked at the airport, why are you coming here? It was not a very welcoming place to come as a tourist or do business. And there was also massive child labor and forced labor in the cotton industry, of which Uzbekistan is the sixth largest producer of cotton. So all of this changed when the former president, President Karimov, passed away in 2016. And his successor, the prime minister, became president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev. And everyone expected things to remain the same. But he initiated a rapid set of reforms. He created a sort of a five-tier initial campaign to privatize the state assets, to liberalize the economy, get rid of capital controls. And that's what set things in motion. So in 2017, I believe, they had floated the Uzbek sum because it had been pegged at about 4,000 Uzbek sum to the dollar. But the bazaar or the black market rate was about 8,000. So no one wanted, it didn't make rational sense for someone to come and invest here and immediately lose 50% of capital. So they liberalized the currency by floating it or by readjusting the peg. They hadn't yet floated it. They floated it in March of 2019, where we then launched our Uzbekistan fund afterwards. So these reforms made it interesting, but actually it was sort of by accident. I was in the region in 2018 to go to a investment tour in Kazakhstan, a country you're very familiar with.
Yeah.
And from a listed equity standpoint, there wasn't a whole lot there. But since I was in the region, I ended up visiting, I spent 2 days in Kyrgyzstan, and then I spent a week in Uzbekistan. And there was no one here. It was very, very quiet. And I kept scratching my head as I met a slew of business people, bankers, brokers, public companies, some people in the hotel and real estate industry, and asking, are these reforms real? And I was thinking, everyone is saying they're real, things are changing, but I couldn't understand why in 2018, no one had caught on to this. I remember I was sitting with our now broker at dinner at a Georgian restaurant, and he pulled up a spreadsheet of some of the listed companies, some of the banks, some of the cement companies, and was looking at their price-to-earnings ratios, and they were growing at 400 or 500%. They were trading at PEs of one or two times, and some of them had dividend yields, I'm not joking, of 50%. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, this isn't supposed to exist in the year 2018. So that caused me to get much more excited about the country and continue to follow it, and that's when we started investing here through our umbrella Asia Frontier Fund.
Who were the investors back then? You said that you didn't see anyone. Who was putting their money into these private entities?
I don't think there was a whole lot. This is when the country had really just begun to open up, and there wasn't a whole lot of money, let alone interest here. Only the summer. During the summer of 2018, did he really start to see a lot of articles being written? For example, before March of 2018, it was illegal to go into the Tashkent metro system and take photos. And it's one of the most beautiful metro systems in the former Soviet Union. So with mosaics and whatnot, but it was illegal to do so. They only lifted that ban 2 months before I came here. So it had just begun to change. And that's when you start to see a lot of positive articles being written. There was no one here, or so it seemed. No one was talking about the stock market. No one was really talking about investment in the country. Everyone that I spoke with afterwards, when I got very excited about the opportunity, said, yeah, we see what's going on, but we're waiting. But if you looked at the reforms that were happening, you realize that the president was pushing so hard, so quick, that it would be very difficult to reverse these reforms that were happening. And now we're at a point where we've just, it's a whole new country. So there wasn't a lot of interest. Now there's a much more interest. It's changed completely. Now there's investment from state enterprises and infrastructure and, you know, development projects of the like. But you're also seeing a lot of private investment and interest in spinning mills for cotton, textile factories to a degree, significant investment in food processing, and just general farming, hotels, et cetera, et cetera. But back then, it still appeared to be very early days.
Well, from what you described, knowing my own history, I think that people were probably in shock, and locals were probably even more skeptical than foreigners on whether the reforms would stick and would they be screwed over if they embrace something. You know, they'd had enough of that in the past.
You know? Certainly, it's the curse of recency bias, where, for example, the 3 years that we've been investing in Uzbekistan, I've been speaking with local friends and saying, you know, they want to buy Apple and Google and Microsoft and Tesla. And I say, you understand that you have companies here that are growing well over 100% per year, that have stupendous dividend yields. And they're saying, yeah, well, there's inflation, the Uzbek sum always depreciates. And historically, that was the case, where before 2016, the currency was depreciating somewhere around 20 or 30% per year. It was rampant inflation. But the central bank now has an inflation targeting regime, and their goal is by next year to get inflation to 10%. I think now it's about 11 or 12%. But when we came here, or right before we came here, it was around 19%. So it's come down significantly. The policy rate from the central bank until last year was 16%. Now it's at 14%. As interest rates are coming down, you're seeing the currency begin to stabilize. And actually, for the past few months, the currency has been appreciating versus the U.S. dollar. I think that the curse of recency bias is actually going to cause people to miss out on what would potentially be a great opportunity, which is actually taking your U.S. dollars, because, as you know, in this part of the world, everyone likes to take their locally owned currency and convert it into USD, because that's a store of value. I think we're on the verge of seeing a shift here, where as you see more money come into the country, as you see inflation fall below 10%, as the policy rate from the central bank falls, you're going to see an increase in desire for people to hold Uzbek sum. And that shift appears to be beginning to change. But as a result, I think locals are going to realize, if I can buy a listed company that has a dividend of 10, 15, 20%, it might be better than just buying U.S. dollars and keeping them under my mattress.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What isn't working? You've described things like, it sounds like a unicorn to me. Where do you see the, it sounds like wonderful progress, but we all know that there are hiccups along the way and other things that hold a country back.
Well, so I've lived in frontier markets for the past 9.5 years, and it is rosy as some of the potential opportunities are. There are always speed bumps, and all of these governments tend to, you know, trip. But luckily, this one keeps tripping and getting up and moving forward. Just as when I lived in Myanmar and you know, in Vietnam, there were always issues for one reason or another. So this country has. Or let's say this country needs to drastically increase its capacity, intellectual capacity in government. You have a lot of people that still have the old way of thinking. There's massive inefficiency and a massive bureaucracy. They're beginning to actually digitize some of the processes of whether it's opening accounts or applying for certain licenses, but they have a long way to go. You're starting from the ground floor. So it can only technically move up or go sideways, of course. Yeah, I think it'll continue to move up, but it's going to be a long grind, because there are some instances where the government will pass a piece of legislation without, I guess you could say, having done enough thought of the potential ramifications of it, and then having to potentially go back and revise it. They had this issue with their value-added tax a few years ago, where the value-added tax, I think, was 20%, and they realized that this was only going to drive people into the gray market economy. So they lowered it, I believe, to 15%. But it caused havoc. So one of the big challenges is just capacity in government. Streamlining processes, eliminating the huge amounts of bureaucracy. There's paperwork for everything, as you know, in this part of the world. One of my favorite indicators, though, was that, you know this word notarius or notariat. And when you're in Kazakhstan, there are notaries everywhere. Here, there are a lot of notaries, but I've never seen more notaries in my life than in Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. So it gives me hope that in due course, you'll see fewer and fewer of them here and things being able to be done online. So that's one of the big challenges.
The government's quite
probably
young.
One of the biggest.
But we're going back 5 years. How are they, where are they looking for external ideas to shape this emerging country?
From the major consulting firms. BCG, McKinsey, so they're actively involved in helping the government, especially along the lines of privatization. But all across, they're trying to help to restructure the economy.
Gotcha. You know, I remember a couple of years ago when you guys set up the AFC Fund, there was a lot of foreign attention given to Uzbekistan. Let's talk a bit more about how are foreign entities and individuals actively involved, and is that growing? Is it stable? How is that perceived by the local government as well as local business?
When we first came here, it was very early days, and we were sort of the only big buyer in the markets. So you had people here that had owned shares for a long time. There was not much liquidity in the market. We came in and they probably thought that we were the sucker. We were buying companies that had dividend yields of, again, up to 50%. And we were very happy with that. They could sell us more. We would have bought more. So we were the first big foreign money to come into the stock market. Writing about it, building a track record here. Certainly, there's been a lot more investment into the stock market here from foreign investors, but also local, whether it's family offices or retail. It's definitely coming in. So the market capitalization, I think, has gone up about 21% since we started investing here. The market capitalization now is $6 billion. There are about 135 companies on the exchange. And over the past few years, the government set up a sort of a Securities and Exchange Commission equivalent, which was focused on regulating financial institutions, regulating public companies, making sure that minorities were protected and their rights were protected. And they did a phenomenal job. So that's been encouraging. The government definitely wants to develop the capital markets, partially because they need to use it as a mechanism to privatize a huge swath of the economy, a lot of which they'll probably do here. Some of the bigger companies they'll plan to IPO or do a list in, I'd imagine, London. For example, you have Navoi Metallurgical Mining Company, which owns the Murrintown Mine, which used to be owned by Newmont Mining. It's the largest open-pit gold mine in the world. So you have them, you have Uzmet Kombinat, which is the largest steel company, I believe, in Central Asia. So some behemoth companies. I mean, this Navoi, which the acronym is NMMC, it's on par with a Newmont or a Barrick.
I remember a couple of years ago, it seemed like everybody and their dog were traveling through Uzbekistan, looking at the investment prospects there. We're now a couple years beyond that. What stuck for people? What does foreign direct investment look like in Uzbekistan?
Sure. So you have in the construction sector, you have a lot of Kazakh and Turkish money. In the textile sector or in textiles / agriculture, so the cotton production and whatnot, you have American investments, Korean, Turkish, Chinese, because the government has incentivized companies or incentivize investors to build spinning mills. For example, starting in 2020, it was illegal to export raw cotton. This country used to export the majority of its cotton to places like China, Bangladesh, where it was then spun into yarn and the value was captured there. As of 2020, it now needs to be processed. So you had a handful of spinning mills that popped up throughout the country. And over the next few years, you're going to see an export tariff put on yarn, which is intended to incentivize factories to move here. So, in agriculture and cotton, you're seeing Turkish, Korean, Chinese investments. Infrastructure, you're seeing a lot of Chinese, mainly EPCs, some of its loans and whatnot. But you have to remember that when it comes to a lot of this stuff, this country is very rich. It has about $34 billion of foreign exchange reserves, about $21, $22 billion of which is gold. It's a $52-odd billion economy. So a lot of the investment that you're seeing around town, a lot of the real estate, a lot of infrastructure that's being built, there's some very big agro-industrial processing groups here, a lot of it's local money. That's actually really good that the money's being invested back into the country. But no doubt you're seeing, as I mentioned, a large amount of a foreign investment from these countries. You're also seeing German and Italian investments in manufacturing. So there's a gypsum board company. It's been here for a handful of years. It's near, I believe, Bukhara, and I believe it's German owned. So a handful of things. This country has the largest population in Central Asia at 34.5 million. No doubt there's more of that to come.
Well, let's talk about the AFC, Uzbekistan Fund. You guys have figured out how to make things work in that region. I follow I read your monthly report, but then also the general AFC reports for various parts of the world. And you are definitely typically at the top of the performance. Tell us about your criteria for investment, what it was 2 years ago when you started, and how that's developed to today.
So we started investing here through our Asia Frontier Umbrella Fund. And then when capital controls were lifted in March of 2019, we set up the dedicated Uzbekistan Fund with about $2 million. And now as of March 2021, we're $11 million. The fund is up 64.5% since we started, and it's up 22.7% year to date. So it's done quite well, partially because we're buying companies with stupendous value. At the same time, superb growth. And a lot of foreigners, but also a lot of locals caught on to the reality that we were sort of cornering the market back when it was exceptionally cheap. We have 20 odd companies in the portfolio, largely materials companies, so cement, steel, vegetable oil processors, mainly because the vast majority of the companies that are listed are either partially state-owned enterprises or formally state-owned enterprises. So it's the typical sort of post-Soviet story of the entire economy is listed. And it tends to be more manufacturing and industry-based companies. So we built a portfolio skewed around, there are some financial services companies. All of the banks are listed, and one of our largest positions is the local commodities exchange, which is sort of the equivalent of the New York Mercantile, the London Metals Exchange, and the COMEX rolled into one, which has done very well for us. So the idea of building our portfolio was to construct it around companies. They'd have levered growth to the economy. So as the economy picks up, as consumption picks up, there's going to be more demand for real estate because this country has about 14 square meters of residential real estate per capita, one of the lowest in the world. They need to build hundreds of thousands of houses, which is going to result in the need for offices, roads, everything else. So steel and cement are no-brainers at the early cycle early stage of where the economy is. And as consumption rises or as incomes rise, consumption will rise. So people will consume more vegetable oil, whether it's in plov or if it's in processed foods. Another big company that we own is the largest food conglomerate in the country, so Tashkent Vino. They have dried fruits, frozen vegetables that they export. They have a slew of soft drinks, water, wine, vodka, beer. So things like this. These are the types of companies that we've looked to invest into that have leverage to the future growth of the country, but that also foreigners are going to say, it's easy to understand. These are the blue chips that we're going to want to buy. So we centered around these unofficial blue chips. And for example, with this Uzbekistan commodities exchange, we started buying it at a price of 2,000 Uzbek sum. As of the end of March, it was trading 12,000 Uzbek sum. And if you look at the dividends for 2018, 2019, 2020, the dividend yield for us based on the price that we've paid for our first few shares is 124%. So we've recouped our initial investment plus some just on the dividend alone. And the way that I'm looking at the development of the capital markets here is, first, you have to have the existing listed companies see a re-rating, because the problem here is a lot of people want to raise capital, but locals don't want to list on the stock exchange because they're going to get a very low multiple. They'd much rather get private equity at a higher multiple. Usually it's the opposite, of course, where listed companies have traded a premium to private equity. Here it's the opposite. So I think to see a normalization in the capital markets here, you need to see the steep discount of listed companies relative to private companies decrease. And as that happens, you'll see, I think, more government privatizations at realistic prices. And that's when I think you start to see a potential IPO boom, where private companies say, we need to raise capital. There's a more developed, more liquid market. There are more local and foreign participants here, but I'll also be able to get a good valuation for our company when we sell X percentage of it. So I think that's the natural progression of the capital markets here. So it's still very early days, and the vast majority of our portfolio is still experiencing really good quality growth and paying, in a handful of cases, double-digit dividends.
Do you see yourselves moving more over to private equity as well? So far you've described that a lot of what you've invested in is semi-privatized or privatized government entities, but what about newer businesses that are being started fresh?
No, our fund will only invest in companies listed on the stock exchange.
Okay. Why that? What's the reason behind that?
Partially due to transparency. The fact that, you know, Asia Frontier Capital is only a listed equities investment manager, that's a big part of it. But if you were to delve into, you know, if an independent investor was to come to Uzbekistan and said, I can invest in the stock market or I can invest in private equity, I think the benefit of the stock market is that you can always push the sell button. There's very good transparency in this country relative to other countries. Every company has to report online quarterly financials, an annual report, dividend information, pretty much everything. So there's a large degree of transparency in that regard, where, of course, in private equity, there isn't. But the more important thing is that the listed companies are cheaper than any private equity deals I've seen in the country. Yeah. So when that reverses, maybe it makes sense to look elsewhere. But I think that, you know, we'll have a long time before that happens. So the listed equities place, or listed equities in the stock market here, I think it's just the place to be.
Very good. Very good. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little more about the macro region. You definitely, you do very well in the micro, but I'm most interested in what you've developed in terms of what you've observed and what you know of this region today. Let's look beyond Uzbekistan. What's going on in the region that shapes your thinking for the future for the region?
I think this part of the world, if you look at Southeast Asia has been a booming growth story. Vietnam is China number two. This part of the world, as you know, having done business here for a few decades, is largely overlooked by investors, partially because of it being former Soviet Union, partially because it's landlocked, or in Uzbekistan's case, double landlocked, so it's not going to be a massive manufacturing center. But if you look at what's happening in China and with the Belt and Road Initiative, and you're starting to see, I think, a bifurcation of the world between sort of East and West. And no doubt Russia and China are allies. You look at this part of the world and think, is the West really going to invest heavily in here and have significant influence? They'll try, of course. They are trying. But I think at the end of the day, this part of the world is going to be brought into sort of a socio-economic, Sino-Russo, economic region, this sort of new burgeoning Eurasia, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to span from Central Asia all the way down to Iran, probably at some point encompass Turkey, but we'll see what happens, being that they're a member of NATO. But I think that this part of the world is going to receive huge amounts of investment, because Russia and China don't want the West between them. And this part of the world has a large amount of resources, and it just makes sense for them to create, again, this Sino-Russo socio-economic region, if you will. And if you look at what's been happening, last month, China finally inked a 25-year deal worth $400 billion, which I'm sure in due course will be more, to invest into the country. And they're going to be investing in infrastructure, mining, oil and gas, manufacturing, technology transfer, upgrading some of their ports, in exchange, of course, for being able to buy Iranian crude at a discount to Brent. But nonetheless, Iran is a fascinating economy. It's large. I think it's 60, 70 million people, if I'm not mistaken. Very highly educated. And it's very diversified. The hydrocarbon industry only represents about 10% of their GDP. They have, an auto industry, massive mining industry, consumer goods industry. A lot of consumer goods end up in this part of the world. You can buy Iranian dates and other Iranian, agricultural products in Uzbekistan. So I think as a result of the opportunity that exists in this part of the world, you're going to see significant investment in rail infrastructure and highways and airports. And it's going to totally transform this part of the world. As part of that, in 2022, I don't think the date has been announced yet, but there's going to be the Shanghai Cooperation Summit in Samarkand, because Samarkand is the natural logistics hub for Uzbekistan, being able to connect Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, going up to Kazakhstan. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in this country from, or this entire region really, from the standpoint of Chinese investment after the summit. I remember living in Cambodia, and I think it was 2014 or 2015, and there was an ASEAN summit, and Prime Minister Hun Sen vetoed discussion about China building artificial islands in the South China Sea. And obviously it's different, but the billions and billions of dollars that poured into Cambodia since, I don't know if you've been in the past few years, but it's totally transformed the country. I don't think it will be the same here, but it won't take a huge amount of money to do a lot in this part of the world. But due to it being geopolitically sensitive, especially all the way down to Iran, the abundance of resources, agricultural, hydrocarbons, gold, uranium, etc., I think you're going to see a total transformation of this part of the world. And it's being overlooked by the vast majority of people, which is what makes it exciting. And that's the reason, one of the reasons that you can still buy real estate in Uzbekistan that yields, 10 or 20% in US dollars. And it's the reason I think that the equities market is still cheap, but I don't think that these assets here will stay cheap forever.
Sure. From what you've described of Uzbekistan, I think that they are in they have a good footing, a good foundation that they've built up over these last several years to not lose their soul in the midst of the economic development of the region. that they can be an active participant rather than just the recipient of external influences. Sounds quite promising for that region. I think before we wrap up, I'd like to ask one more question of you, Scott, and that is for Western investors, non-frontier market natives, what advice would you give with regard to how, where, when, what to invest in the region?
Touch real quick on what you mentioned before asking that question in terms of Uzbekistan playing a greater role in the region. I think that Uzbekistan, if they play their cards right, will be the most influential country in all of Central Asia. And the reason is because of the population, the wealth, diversification of the economy. But you're already seeing it where Uzbekistan has been hosting peace talks between Western powers and the Taliban. So Uzbekistan is going to become a major trading partner and investor, at least in the northern half of Afghanistan. They're building the plan is to build a railroad through northern Afghanistan over to Pakistan to get access to the port at Gwadar. They've done land swaps with, I believe, Kyrgyzstan in disputed areas. The president a few weeks ago was talking with the government in Kyrgyzstan, and they're, for years they've been talking about building a rail corridor through Kyrgyzstan, but the Kyrgyz don't have the money. The Chinese have already lent billions of dollars to Kyrgyzstan, so there's talk that Uzbekistan might be willing to actually finance the section of the rail that runs through Kyrgyzstan to get it built, which means that you'll be able to run, you know, rail from China through Kyrgyzstan, through Uzbekistan, and in due course through Turkmenistan to the Caspian Sea, down to Iran. And Uzbekistan is at the center of all of this. And more importantly, Uzbekistan is a way for China to access Europe without going through Russia. Mm-hmm. So I certainly think that this country is going to be able to flex its muscle when it comes to being involved in the region. So to answer your question, sorry.
All good.
What to invest in? I guess it depends on what one is looking to invest in. I'm biased, of course, and we'll say the equities market. You don't have to come here to open a brokerage account. You can do it online, or you can do it through email via your broker. You have to mail physical documents here. It's a bit bureaucratic. But everything, I think, is an opportunity in this part of the world. Real estate's very cheap. Real estate, agriculture, trading, processing, growing. Textile manufacturing is going to be big business in this part of the world. I think that Uzbekistan will probably become a regional Vietnam of sorts, where there will be significant industry here and there'll be a big exporter to Central Asia, but also to the greater regions such as Russia and Belarus and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't have anything specific to say in terms of what someone should be looking to invest into.
What about cautions as well? Because it's not really for the frontier markets, are not for the naive and the faint of heart. But there are avenues for those that are less experienced to get involved in the region.
True. I'd say that beyond investing maybe in the stock market or through a fund like us, I think probably the first step that someone should take is come to the region, learn about the culture, see how the people are, look at the opportunity for themselves. That's one of the biggest realizations that I had years ago, is that whatever you read in the news, it's not necessarily wrong, it's not necessarily biased, but it doesn't necessarily tell the whole picture, and you also get a much better feel for everything on the ground. So I guess probably the best answer is to say, come to the region on vacation and enjoy yourself and look around and see what opportunities exist.
You, in your most recent monthly report, you gave a link to an article written by a travel writer. I can't remember who it was, but I love that you can now take express trains between Tashkent and Samarkand. I have yet to go down to Samarkand. or to Bukhtara, and a lot easier travel than the last time I was there.
The express goes actually all the way to Bukhara, and they're expanding it to Hiva, and it's Spanish trains financed wholly by the Uzbek government, which is unique relative to other, say, frontier markets where they might get a loan from the AIIB or whatnot. But the infrastructure here is improving. For someone coming from, say, America or Singapore, the infrastructure here is not great. But I, having lived in Vietnam years ago, it's improved since, but Cambodia, Myanmar, Mongolia, I was blown away at the infrastructure in this country. And it's only going to get better. So certainly it's not roughing it. I have never ridden a camel in this part of the world.
You know what? I haven't either. I've been involved since 1990 in that region. In fact, I think 1991 I was in Tashkent, and I've seen a few camels, but never ridden one. Consumed their milk. Oh, hey, Scott, this is great. I think this is Obrus has its roots in the frontier markets. That was their focus when I first got involved. This was before your time of being the on-the-ground person for Obrus in Mongolia. But it's definitely frontier markets are true to my heart. And I love introducing people to the frontier markets and helping them shape their own views so that they can be competent and confident in investing in the regions, in various regions. As you've demonstrated, there's a lot happening and there are a lot of long-term opportunities there. Thanks very much for joining us for this interview. And I'll look forward to being kept up to date on what you're involved with. And who knows, we may very well find our way to Uzbekistan, hopefully while you're still there. We don't have any events scheduled in that region, but I take a handful of people with me when I travel, and would love to introduce some folks to you and to AFC as well as to Uzbekistan. So thank you, sir.
Thanks, James. Yeah, we'll have to go out for Pulau.
Sounds good. Thanks for joining us for the Global Investor Podcast. If you like what you've heard, we have much more to offer you. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel or to the podcast itself. Obrus is an investor syndicate. We are defined by people, places, and deals. Our members and guests are an amazing group of self-made and accomplished investors and entrepreneurs. We come from 15 different countries and a wide variety of professions. We share the common pursuits of surrounding ourselves with great people and great places while gaining significant returns in investing. Please head over to our website, obrusinvest.com, where you can learn more about Obrus, our members, investing with us, and our world-class events. That's obrusinvest.com. We also invite you to sign up for our free Global Investor Newsletter. You'll have access to our weekly insights as well as deep dives into specific industries and global markets. And be sure to come to an Obrus event. There is no better way to get to know us than through our events. We are currently working on our next live in-person event. Check out our website for details. My partners and I created Obrus to facilitate freedom, wealth, adventure, and connection. With Obrus, you'll experience a whole new world of investing.